A constitutional test today on The World. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein went to the White House today and the rumors flew. Was he getting fired? Resigning? Actually, no. But he will meet with President Trump later this week. What does it mean?
This has been a successful test of the constitutional crisis monitoring system.
How's all this going down in China? Leaders there interpret the stories of Washington chaos and dysfunction as weakness.
And they say, you Chinese people, would you like to have a country that looks like this? You know, we have a steady, qualified leader who's worked his way up through the ranks.
Beijing is also reaching out to the American heartland. The Chinese government just placed a big ad in the Des Moines Register. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Washington was abuzz earlier today when word started circulating that Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein had resigned. That was one reported story. The other was that he was heading to the White House to be fired. In fact, no such thing has happened yet. But Rosenstein did meet with senior White House staff today. A meeting with President Trump is now scheduled for Thursday. Rosenstein, you'll remember, oversees the special counsel investigation led by Robert Mueller into Russia's involvement in the 2016 election. I asked Susan Glasser, a staff writer at The New Yorker, what she made of it all.
Somebody just tweeted, this has been a successful test of the constitutional crisis monitoring system. You know, really, for a long time, since Mueller was appointed, as you know, President Trump has raged against the Mueller investigation, calling it illegitimate and furious at his own attorney general, Jeff Sessions, for recusing himself from supervising it. The result is that because Sessions is not supervising Mueller, Rod Rosenstein has been the supervisor as the deputy attorney general. So by firing Rosenstein, Trump effectively would be reasserting control over the Mueller investigation. And that's the reason that for more than a year, Democrats on Capitol Hill, observers have been worried about exactly this moment. And so the other day, of course, there was this damaging New York Times story, really incredible story, saying that Rosenstein had spoken with colleagues about whether to invoke the 25th Amendment and try to remove President Trump from office, said possibly jokingly that maybe he should wear a wire to the White House because that would show people how incoherent or problematic President Trump was. And so, again, that naturally has raised the question of what is the future of Rod Rosenstein in a Trump administration, given these views of the president he has shared with colleagues.
Let's go back to the Rod Rosenstein as the person overseeing Mueller. Where does the Russia probe stand at this moment?
Good question. Wouldn't we all like to know that? Right now, Mueller, as you know, has achieved guilty pleas from a number of people like George Papadopoulos, most recently Paul Manafort. He's indicted the Russian hackers and trolls at the Internet Research Agency in St. Petersburg. But core questions of the probe so far remain publicly unanswered. What, if anything, has Mueller and his team turned up when it comes to the question of President Trump or his campaign's involvement, knowledge of, collusion with the 2016 Russian hacking? We don't know the answer to that yet.
Now, all this comes as the UN General Assembly gathers in New York this week. President Trump is expected to give his address to the gathering tomorrow. What will you be looking for?
It is this incredible, once again, split-screen moment, right? We have this very inward-looking series of interlocking political crises here in the United States. We have, you know, this question of the Mueller investigation. We have the Kavanaugh hearings playing out. And then the president traveling once again to New York after having questioned the value of traditional American alliances and really upended American foreign policy and the sense that people know what kind of American presence in the world the United States is all about right now. And so I think there'll be enormous scrutiny around the world of President Trump's address. And, you know, I would look for him to continue to use strongly worded rhetoric when it comes to America firstism. The address will be once again written by Stephen Miller, his very hawkish anti-immigration young domestic policy advisor.
Now, it's been a year since Trump's first foray to the General Assembly. I mean, is he a different person as he arrives this year?
Well, you know, it's like the bad boyfriend theory. You can't really change your boyfriend no matter how much you can try, right? I think Donald Trump at over the age of 71 is not changing a lot. However, he does appear to be at a different moment in his Trumpian foreign policy. So last year, he not only called Kim Jong-un little rocket man from the unusual platform of the UN General Assembly, but had very bellicose rhetoric toward both Iran and North Korea. He's in a different place on both of those things right now. He's already withdrawn from the Iranian nuclear deal, and yet he said he's open to meeting with Iranian President Rouhani anytime. Obviously, he had his very friendly feeling summit meeting with Kim Jong-un in Singapore earlier this summer. So rather than little rocket man, you know, the New York Times, I think, put it well this morning. His advisors are actually worried that President Trump might err too far in the other direction of reaching out to authoritarian leaders and seeming to want to sit down at the negotiating table with them.
Susan Glasser is a staff writer at The New Yorker. Thanks, Susan.
Thank you so much.
Another big issue for the Trump administration is the ongoing trade war with China. This weekend, the Chinese government reached out directly to Trump country. It paid for a 4-page supplement in Sunday's Des Moines Register that referred to the, quote, fruit of a president's folly. That's China's take on the trade war. And it's escalating today with $200 billion in new tariffs on Chinese exports to the U.S. taking effect. China is promising new tariffs of its own. The World's Jason Margolis takes a look at how this is playing in Iowa.
When Dave McNear opened Sunday's Des Moines Register and saw the supplement from China, he shrugged it off.
Number one, I tend to look at those type of ads just as what they are. They're an advertisement.
McNear runs Maxim Advertising in Newton, Iowa. He was also Donald Trump's merchandising man in Iowa during the 2016 campaign. He says this about China reaching out directly to Iowans yesterday.
It does annoy me. It does frustrate me because I think they're doing it for purely political reasons. You know, they know that President Trump won the election in the heartland and throughout the middle of the country, and some of his biggest, most ardent supporters are here.
McNear says President Trump isn't the one to blame for escalating trade tensions with China.
I am fine with President Trump, you know, sticking to his guns, and, you know, we've been taken advantage of for a long, long, long time. And somebody's finally standing up for the U.S. and trying to equalize some trade imbalances.
But the situation in Iowa right now has many there deeply concerned.
You know, Iowans are nervous.
Joe Murphy is with the Greater Des Moines Partnership, the regional chamber of commerce.
We're obviously an agricultural state. We have a significant presence in advanced manufacturing, and our state economy really depends on our ability to have access to those foreign markets.
China, paramount among them. China is targeting exports of U.S. soy and pork, two huge commodity exports from Iowa. Overall, the state's economy could lose up to $2 billion from the current tariff spats. That's according to research from agricultural economist Dave Swenson at Iowa State University.
And the ag economy going into this year was expecting an expansion in trade opportunities in soybeans and in pork production to Asia, and everything has been reversed.
Swenson says the tariff issue has been front and center for weeks and weeks in Iowa, and he thinks it's starting to take a toll on President Trump's base.
The rock-rib strong sentiment that most of rural Iowa had toward the administration is starting to crack.
But will China's advertisement yesterday speed that up? Grant Kimberly is a soybean farmer in Maxwell, Iowa. He actually met Xi Jinping in 2012, just before he became China's president.
We hosted him on our farm when he came to visit his old friend, then governor, now Ambassador Branstad.
That's former Iowa Governor Terry Branstad. Kimberly had this reaction to opening his Sunday paper.
I thought, that's not subtle. They're certainly trying to influence people. And
still, he doesn't think the ad will have much impact in Iowa.
I mean, I think ultimately, you know, people have their minds kind of made up, whether it's on one side of it or the other side of the issue. So
he says what will change minds is if the trade war continues.
It'll come down to how long this lasts. This is protracted, extended disagreement. You know, the consequences are going to be more severe for Iowa and agriculture in general.
Kimberly says Iowa farmers sold a lot of their products on contract before the tariffs took effect. But he says if the spat rolls into next year, then they'll really be feeling the pain. So he just wants the two sides to come up with a compromise to end the trade dispute. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Jennifer Lind is not surprised China is sending a message directly to Iowa. Lind is a China expert at Dartmouth College.
The Chinese government has gotten extremely sophisticated about strategic communications in a wide variety of areas in terms of communicating its message worldwide, targeting specific communities, the Chinese diaspora, for example. And so this doesn't surprise me. This sounds like very much the kind of sophisticated level of messaging that we've come to expect from Beijing.
Should we assume that this ad is betraying the concern China has about this growing trade war with the U.S.?
Well, obviously, China is extremely concerned about this trade war. The Trump administration's calculation is that China stands to lose a great deal more than the U.S. from this trade war. And so the Trump administration is basically trying to wait them out. And so it's certainly no surprise that they're feeling the pain of this, and they are looking for ways to bring this to a quick end.
China seems to be flexing its muscles all over the world. I mean, it's expanding its military and naval influence in the South China Sea. I mean, almost up to the shores of the Philippines, Malaysia, and Vietnam with these kind of created islands. How effectively can the U.S. counter that kind of Chinese expansion?
The growth of Chinese military power in Asia is absolutely one of the most important features of the world today. We can certainly overstate the extent to which there's this well-oiled machine in which everything is being efficiently and purposefully aimed toward one specific goal. But at the same time, I think we do see a pretty clear strategic vision there. And for the most part, it's being implemented in a very visible way, in a very obvious way. China is interested in becoming a dominant military player in the region, a dominant economic player and diplomatic player. And it's putting resources, extensive resources, toward all of these goals. And there's a noticeable change in recent years in their level of activity and their level of effort.
Let's turn that around, and I want to ask you, do you see a coherent strategy within the Trump administration toward China, or do you see it as a singular focus on trade?
It's hard to use the word coherent these days because we have so much thrown at us by this administration. It just feels like U.S. policy is in a great deal of turmoil. It feels like U.S. politics are in such turmoil that it really is hard to say, oh, there's, you know, this clear, coherent approach that's going on. But I think there is more coherence, more stability on the U.S. side, at least as it pertains to China, than we might otherwise think. Trump as a candidate disparaged U.S. alliances in Asia, but under his administration, he has recommitted to those alliances with South Korea, Japan, and others. You know, the U.S. has been the dominant military power in Asia, and Trump is certainly committed to remaining that way. So, you know, if you're China, if you're looking at it from Beijing's perspective, perhaps you see more coherence than we Americans do when we look around us.
Jennifer Lind of Dartmouth College, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Just ahead, Vancouver, BC tries a different approach to helping some heroin addicts. It's prescribing heroin as treatment. It's on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're listening to The World. We have a story coming up from Canada, yes, our neighbor to the north, a country whose system of government is different to ours and therefore perplexing. Last Friday, we showed you just how perplexed we are. We referred to Doug Ford as the Prime Minister of Ontario. He's not. Canadian provinces do not have prime ministers. Ford is the Premier of Ontario. That's roughly equivalent, very roughly, to a state governor. Thanks to several listeners who pointed out our mistake, we'll try harder in the future, starting right now, because we're back with another story from north of the border. This one also concerns how Canadians deal with the opioid crisis. Like the U.S., Canada is experiencing an unprecedented number of deaths due to overdoses. Authorities there have been experimenting for years with different strategies to address the opioid epidemic. Often, heroin addiction is treated with maintenance medications like methadone. But in some cases, doctors in Canada are actually prescribing heroin to treat heroin addiction itself. Alana Gordon has the story from Vancouver.
Every day, Brent Olson travels about 20 minutes by train into Vancouver's downtown east side. He's got a degenerative right hip and uses a walker to get around. But there's no way he'd miss this clinic appointment.
It's the best decision I've ever made in my life was coming here. And now it's changed my life. And I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you if I hadn't found this place. And I'd be dead like dinner, done.
Olson goes past the double security entrances, checks in, and heads to a room in the back. Inside, a health worker hands him a syringe through a window. He sits at a long metal table against a wall that's lined with mirrors.
I take the lid off.
A nurse stands by as he finds a good spot on the inside of his arm to inject his drugs.
And I put it in my vein, and I go it in like this, and I'm done. Take a Kleenex, put it over top of it, and then take a Band-Aid to stop it from bleeding. And then after that, I put my cap on my lid, I return it, and that's the name of that show.
3 times a day, Olson visits Providence Healthcare's Crosstown Clinic in Vancouver to receive a closely monitored shot of diacetylmorphine, also known as prescription heroin.
I'm on an amount that's a little below average in the amount, and it does the job for me.
Hey, Brent?
Yeah.
I'm going to give you your medication.
Okay.
Olson goes to a table outside the injection room and gets a cup with medications for his other health issues. Olson is 55. He's wearing a bright red sports jersey. Growing up, he had big hockey dreams. He wanted to play professionally. But one day during practice, he destroyed his ankle. He couldn't compete anymore. He spiraled into drugs.
You know, I can say one thing about my whole life and everything. Is that I don't know if it's good or bad, but between the ages of 30 and 40, I can't tell. I don't know what I've done.
Olson says he does know. He spent years shoplifting, in jail, and doing whatever he had to do to feed his heroin addiction. He did try traditional treatment, taking methadone every day. He says that didn't work for him. But back on the streets, he knew he was risking his life, never knowing exactly what he was getting and whether that heroin fix he so desperately sought would be his last. Then he enrolled in Crosstown's clinic.
Well, you know what you're getting here. You know you're safe here. You know that you're not going to, you're not going to die.
Today, Olson is one of dozens of patients here who inject a measured dose of prescription heroin. Doctors like Scott McDonald consider it a form of treatment for opioid addiction.
This is just one treatment for a chronic manageable illness, just like diabetes or high blood pressure. It's no different.
McDonald is Crosstown's lead doctor. Before coming here, he worked around the corner, providing traditional first-line treatments for addiction like methadone. That and buprenorphine are the standard medications taken by mouth. But McDonald says not everyone benefits.
This is a life-saving intervention for a small number of folks with a chronic, manageable illness that haven't responded to anything else.
McDonald says studies show conventional addiction treatments don't work for about 1 in 10 people. Research has found for them, they're more likely to stick with prescription heroin than standard treatment. The United Kingdom has used it for nearly a century. Several other European countries have their own programs, too. Crosstown got its start as a pilot study in 2005, becoming the first place in North America to prescribe patients heroin to treat addiction. The clinic imports the drug from Switzerland. Treating an illegal drug addiction with the very drug that people are addicted to may seem like a radical idea. But it's catching on in Canada because of all the overdose deaths.
Now everything's changed. We need to get people opportunity to get a safer supply of drugs.
Mark Tindall directs the region's Center for Disease Control and is a longtime doctor in the neighborhood surrounding Crosstown Clinic. He spent his career working on ways to reduce the harms of drug use. But even with these efforts, a deadly narcotic called fentanyl that's being mixed in with street drugs has upped the stakes. British Columbia experienced a record 1,400 drug-related deaths last year.
If it's at the point where every flop of drugs that people are buying could be, have a high amount of fentanyl and a potent, deadly supply of fentanyl, I don't know what harm reduction service we can do to fight that.
The Canadian regional government has been pushing for an expansion of prescription heroin, providing more funding and backing new clinical guidelines. But this approach is not being embraced everywhere in Canada.
You know, making drugs that are addictive more available is just going to exacerbate the problem.
Marilyn Gladue is a member of the Canadian Parliament representing a county in Ontario. She says the government needs to focus on putting resources into traditional addiction treatment, not prescription heroin.
keeping somebody safely addicted to drugs is not my definition of success. We would really prefer to see people not get on drugs in the first place or see them treated to get them off drugs.
But the government has eased restrictions on who can prescribe heroin for the treatment of addiction. Most of the clinics offering it, or an injectable pain medication called hydromorphone that's been found to be as effective, are in Vancouver. And the approach has some surprising supporters.
I've been a member of the Vancouver Police Department for 22 years now, and most of that time I've been involved in drug enforcement.
Police, like Bill Spearin. Spearin says his unit makes plenty of drug busts, but fentanyl is cheap and widespread. He sees drug addiction as a health problem, and prescription heroin is just one of many types of treatment for that problem. He says it also keeps people out of jail and the criminal justice system.
I think it would prevent people from having to go out and commit crime in order to support their habit, or spending every dime that they earn to, you know, maintain their opioid addiction.
A handful of new clinics are slated to open in other parts of Canada in the coming months. And since last year, the number of people taking prescription heroin or another kind of injectable opioid to treat addiction has more than doubled in British Columbia, up to about 250 patients. But that number is tiny compared to the tens of thousands of people still injecting illegal drugs and risking a fatal overdose. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Before we go to the break, here's a preview of something we've got coming up tomorrow. It's about the Brett Kavanaugh hearing and the conversation in Canada.
We're taking your calls on the Me Too movement. Where do you want the conversation to go next? Let us know. The number is...
A CBC radio talk show host opened up the phones today across Canada to talk with women and men. The conversation got around to the subject of redemption for abusers. Many listeners agreed it may be too early for that.
Reintegration and rehabilitation are both fine, but the first step is acknowledging your behavior.
What Canadians are saying about Me Too. Our conversation with the CBC's Anna Maria Tremonti, that's right here on the show tomorrow. I'm Carol Hills. It's called the golden cage when one spouse gets a coveted H-1B visa, but the other doesn't have permission to work in the U.S.
You know, it's making them reconsider why they're spending their lives working in a country that won't allow them to have the rights of other workers.
That story later in the show. I'm Carol Hills, and you're listening to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Hundreds of people spilled into the streets of Nicaragua's capital on Sunday to demand the resignation of President Daniel Ortega. Ortega is a former guerrilla leader who first became president in the 1980s, but critics say he's become like a dictator himself, siding with elites and silencing opposition protesters. Human rights activists say about 300 people have been killed since mass protests began in April. And growing numbers of Nicaraguans are trying to get out. Hundreds have been crossing the border into Costa Rica every day, and others are heading north to Mexico and to the U.S. Emily Green has the story.
Tapachula, Mexico is on the border with Guatemala and has become a hub for Central Americans fleeing their countries. At one of the city's many shelters for migrants, kids are playing on the jungle gym set out front. Maciel Garcia stands off to the side with her three-year-old, Casey. She's a shy girl with chubby cheeks who's grabbing onto her mother's leg with one hand and holding a small video player with the other. Garcia and her daughter are from Nicaragua. They arrived here with Garcia's husband a few days ago. It took them almost a week to get here through two countries. They traveled by bus and taxi, and even on a raft to cross a river from Guatemala into Mexico.
I was a nurse in Nicaragua in a hospital. Me obligaron a andar en marchas del gobierno.
Garcia, who is 25, worked as a nurse in a hospital in Nicaragua. She says her bosses forced her to march in support of President Ortega to counter the mass street protests demanding Ortega's resignation. The Nicaraguan president has been criticized for favoring the elite and has responded to the protest with a violent crackdown, killing hundreds of people. Garcia says she was fired because her employer saw her treating injured anti-government protesters who had been shot by security forces. Garcia starts crying as she explains the police then came to her house looking for her. She and her family hid under the bed.
tiene que salir adelante. Piensa en su bebé.
She says she left Nicaragua because she was afraid for her life. And she has a kid and needs to move forward. She and her husband want to reach Los Angeles, where they have family. Normally, it's people from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador who come through here in large numbers to flee gang violence and extreme poverty. But shelter workers in southern Mexico say in recent months, a record number of Nicaraguans are escaping political violence there. Like Luis Alberto Cruz, he's standing outside the shelter talking with some of his cousins who just fled with him from Nicaragua. Cruz is a 24-year-old farm worker. His right eye is swollen and purple, and he has a fresh scar that extends from the corner of it onto his forehead. He says he was beaten up by security forces while marching with anti-government protesters.
Lo odio. Y si llego allá me mata. Ahorita si llego.
I hate Ortega, he says, and if I return, I'll be killed.
No tengo dinero, no tengo... ¿Qué ando yendo más que tú? Entonces yo vengo aquí jugándome la vida.
I don't have money, he says. I don't have anything. I'm here running for my life. That a farm worker, like Cruz, is being persecuted underscores how widespread the protests and government crackdown has become in Nicaragua.
What's changed is the scope with which people have been targeted.
Alexander Parkan is an attorney with the group Human Rights First. He says until this year, the few people fleeing Nicaragua were mostly outspoken political activists. But he says now the violence is focused on regular people, teachers, bus drivers, nurses, who are considered enemies of the president.
Groups of people have been wrapped up in these protests and targeted in extremely severe ways. This is persecution against people who are expressing an anti-government political opinion.
According to Mexican immigration officials, the number of Nicaraguans detained has increased 125% since April, after mass protests erupted. A week after I meet Maciel Garcia and her family on the border, I call her. She and her family have made it to the U.S.-Mexican border in Tijuana. She tells me she is applying for asylum to get to her relatives in Los Angeles.
Okay, te
voy a llamar más tarde.
Sí, yo te llamo más tarde.
Okay,
chao.
But after that first phone call, I can't reach her. Her phone goes straight to voicemail. Lawyers representing migrants say a growing number of Nicaraguans are either stuck in Mexico, waiting for an appointment with border officials, or being held in detention on the U.S. side. And the wait is likely to get longer as a growing number of Nicaraguans flee violence and try to find a home in the U.S. For The World, Emily Green, Tapachula, Mexico.
Recognize this voice?
Today, we are announcing a new set of features coming soon around dating.
It's Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg at his company's annual conference for developers back in May.
Now, this is going to be for building real long-term relationships, all right? Not just hookups.
That announcement raised a lot of eyebrows. Facebook was embroiled in the Cambridge Analytica scandal around that time, and it was facing tough questions about the mishandling of millions of users' personal data. But Facebook pressed on with its dating feature, and last week it started rolling it out for testing in Colombia. Facebook's very popular there, and meeting online is getting more acceptable.
Ya no está estigmatizado.
Fabian Molina Leguizamón is an Uber driver in Bogotá.
Incluso mi sobrino conoció una persona por Facebook y hoy en día pues la.
My nephew met his partner on Facebook, and today they've been together 6 years. These days, the idea of meeting people online seems very normal to me.
Still, some wonder why Facebook picked Colombia. But Cristina Ocampo, a software developer in Bogotá, says why not Colombia?
Pues uno que me pareció bastante interesante que estemos como en el radar de Facebook, o sea, en el radar de social.
It seemed interesting to me that we are on Facebook's radar, that they say Colombia's population is interesting to study and see how it behaves, and how that might be useful when thinking about taking the service to other countries. That we are statistically relevant and part of this scenario, it could mean other software companies might bring their business to Colombia, and that, yes, it is interesting to do business here.
To find out about all this, we called up Lisa Talia Moretti. She's a digital sociologist and strategist based in London.
It's a really, really interesting strategic move, I think, by Facebook. Places like the US and the UK, they've a lot more economic potential, and Facebook makes a lot more money from those advertisers. So if something goes wrong in Colombia, they have less to lose financially.
What's interesting about this is that this is a dating app. So, of course, it's interested in people's information and people's information and sharing that is what Facebook has been under serious fire for. Do you have a sense of how this Facebook dating app will work? Will it use people's Facebook profiles to generate the information? How will it actually work?
Well, it's really interesting that they're moving into this space because they've said that it's going to be completely separated from the Facebook platform. So it's going to be separate from any of the ads that are served. In fact, they've said that it's going to be completely ad-free. Of course, they do have a huge amount of information about every single person who's already on Facebook. There is, you know, definitely a very skeptical part of me that thinks that this might be a really great way for them to test advances in any kind of AI technology in a much more targeted, more personal way.
Has Facebook said what, if anything, it's going to do with the data it collects on this dating app?
They have not said anything about that, but they've been very careful about the kind of privacy settings that they have included in the app. So first of all, the app is completely opt-in, and there's also things like you can't follow up with people who haven't responded to you. So that's trying to ensure that they can keep stalking to a minimum.
It's hard not to think that Facebook is releasing this data app only in one country, Colombia, in some ways to kind of have it behind the scenes, to kind of get the kinks out and figure out how it works and to not be scrutinized.
Colombia is connected, you know, to the rest of the world like so many other countries, and they're definitely going to be scrutinized. They're not going to be able to get away with, you know, doing things in an unethical way. I think from a political point of view, they're probably protected a lot more in Colombia than they would be in the US or the UK, where there is a really strong government infrastructure in place, or stronger, should I say, government infrastructure in place to find them if something did go wrong. In Colombia, this is still quite new, and there isn't really a very strong privacy and data policy infrastructure in place just yet. So I think This was a political and strategic move on behalf of them.
Lisa Talia Moretti is a digital sociologist and strategist, and she's been speaking to us from London. Thanks, Lisa.
Thank you so much. It was really lovely to be on the show. Thank you.
There's a chill in the air here in Boston today. Well, we are officially into fall, so swimming outdoors is almost done. In London, though, there's some year-round spots for the city's residents to take a dip. Three open-air ponds that have been part of London's swimming history for a century. But earlier this year, there was a fight about who could go into one of them, the women's only pond. The World's Allison Herrera has the story.
When you're getting ready to go for a dip in the pool, a lake, or a pond, the last thing you should have to worry about is changing into your swimsuit. But that's exactly what happened to Jane Fay in 2008, when she took her then 5-year-old son to a local swimming pool. She went into the women's changing area, and then
this man just barred the way and went, "You're not going in there." And I said, "Why not?" And he just said, "Well, I'm going to hit you if you do."
I met Fay at a cafe in Soho. At the time when Faye was threatened, she was early on in her transition from male to female. The experience in the changing room was frightening.
I learned very early on in transition that men were dangerous.
When she heard about the Hampstead Heath Ladies Pond, a women's only swimming pond in the middle of London, she assumed it was a safe space for all women, including trans women like her.
The general feeling is that at present, at least in this country, trans people have rights, and those rights are upheld by the law.
Between changing rooms and the infamous bathroom bill controversy in North Carolina, trans men and women are becoming more vocal about their rights. And this means being accepted for the sex they identify as, not the one they were born into. And if that means taking a dip in a pond that's been a women's only space for the last 100 years, then that's their right.
And if you look just down to the bottom of it, to the left, you'll see the dome of St. Paul's Cathedral.
Nikki Mayhew is my tour guide to the sweeping view of Parliament Hill at Hampstead Heath. She's been walking her dog here and swimming at the Ladies' Pond for almost 15 years now.
Because it's one of the ways of making a big city bearable.
tucked quietly within the nearly 800-acre heath, what we Americans would call a park, is a hand-dug, spring-fed pond visited by thousands of women every year. Earlier this year, some of those women had a problem with some of the other swimmers.
There are some people who are very, very perturbed by the idea of trans women swimming here.
Swimmers sent angry emails to Mayhew, who is the co-chair of the Kenwood Ladies Pond Association, about men being allowed to use the pond.
And I have dealt with correspondence from people who have suffered sexual violence at the hands of men and who have been very scared by the idea of what they perceive as men swimming here.
Mayhew doesn't dismiss those concerns, but she's quick to acknowledge that trans women suffer too.
I mean, if you look at the research on the experiences of transgender women, they are often people who have been the victims of violence and abuse and bullying.
The whole thing just blew up. The Daily Mail, a British tabloid, got wind of it and published what Mayhew considered to be a sensational anti-trans article. Swimmers quoted in the article called transgender women, quote, cross-dressers, and said they were, quote, appalled that men were invading their space.
My personal reaction was horror.
The City of London, which manages the pond, stepped in. A meeting was called between various organizations, including women from a transgender swimming club, to get to the bottom of the incident. And it's all pretty clear. Denying trans women access to the ladies' pond is against the law. The Equalities Act, which was passed in 2010, says so. It was passed to make sure discrimination does not happen in public spaces. Jane Fay feels that a lot has changed since the day she was threatened at the pool. And it's a big part of why she prefers to go to places that are just for women.
There is a constant danger to women from predatory men, and that's always the case.
The day I visit the deep, murky waters of the ladies' pond for a swim, Mayhew and some of the other lifeguards I talk to point out a sign that clearly states transgender women are allowed in this place. The UK is about to reauthorize the Gender Recognition Act to make it easier to change the name on your birth certificate and therefore easier to be recognized for the gender you feel you are. But trans women, like they, know that it will take more than an act of legislation or a sign on a pond to change people's minds. For The World, I'm Alison Herrera, London.
It was called the Golden Cage. A spouse, usually a husband, would get an H-1 visa issued to high-skilled workers to come to the U.S. The wife would come too as a dependent on an H-4 visa, but she couldn't work because she didn't have a work permit. That's the Golden Cage. In recent years, the spouses of H-1B visa holders were able to get work permits of their own. But now the Department of Homeland Security is threatening to revoke those work permits. But it's not clear when that might happen, and it's leaving families in limbo. So some are making alternate plans, like moving to Canada. Sonia Paul is a reporter in Oakland, California. She's been following this story for The World.
H-1B visas are the visas available for high-skilled foreign workers in the U.S. So the sort of classic H-1B visa worker is a tech worker, although it also includes doctors and teachers. But if you were to look at the top companies who employ H-1B visa workers, you'd see major tech firms like Google, Amazon, and Apple. And so it's quite a large workforce.
And so the H-4 visas, how are they connected to the H-1Bs?
The H-4 visa is the visa available for dependents of the H-1B visa worker. So that includes spouses and children.
And do H-4 visas allow those dependents to work in the U.S.?
No. People on the H-4 visa alone cannot work. H-1B visa holders are temporary workers, but after a certain number of years, if they're still here in the U.S. and their employer also wants them to continue working, they can apply for sponsorship from their company and with that apply for a green card. And once they have a green card, then their spouses on the H-4 visa are also eligible for this thing called the H-4 EAD, which stands for the Employment Authorization Document. And then they can start working. Since the wait times for green cards can really vary depending on the country of origin of a family, it basically helps people start their quote-unquote permanent lives in the U.S. a little bit sooner.
So what is the Department of Homeland Security doing now? What's the change?
So right now, the Department of Homeland Security is acting under President Trump's Buy American, Hire American executive order. The rule that allowed H-4 spouses to work, the H-4 EAD, happened under Obama. And so at the end of last year, conversation started that this would be revoked. The argument is that they want to protect jobs for American workers. The process to do that, you know, requires a number of federal regulations. It has to open for public comment. The government essentially has to write a new rule. But the procedure is just taking a very long time. And nobody's really sure why it's taking so long. But what's clear is that the delay is causing a lot of anguish for people and uncertainty about what is actually happening.
You profiled one woman who's waiting to see if this rule passes. What's her story?
Yeah, her name is Archna, and she currently lives in Fremont, California. And her story is pretty typical for a lot of spouses who are on the H-4 visa. She first came to the U.S. in 2005 with her husband, who's a software engineer. The majority of H-1B workers are from India, and she herself is an Indian national as well. And what a lot of these spouses encountered when they came to the U.S. and realized they couldn't work is depression. You know, they're very highly motivated individuals in their own right who are independent, but they were put in what people started to dub as a golden cage. And for Archna, she decided to just really put herself forward, even without any clarity of what might happen. She started taking classes at a community college. She got a bachelor's degree in the U.S. She got a fellowship to get a master's degree in the U.S. She has a baby who was born in the U.S. and is a U.S. citizen. And now in California, she works in user design. And so she and her husband, they've been waiting for a green card for years. But because a lot of people don't know what might happen with the H-4 EAD, and, you know, underlying that is the wait times that a lot of people have to get a green card, they're considering life outside of the U.S., whether it's going back home to where they're from or moving to another country that seems to have friendlier immigration policies.
And how many H-4 visa holders will this affect?
There's one University of Tennessee study that estimates about 100,000 H-4 EAD holders will be affected. And this disproportionately affects people from countries like India and China.
Are there other options for people who are uncertain about whether they'll be able to work? Say you have an H-4 visa and you have the EAD. Could you go and apply for an H-1B visa?
If you're working in a job that's eligible for an H-1B visa, then yeah. But speaking anecdotally from the people I've talked to who are on the H-4, they don't really work in spaces that sponsor H-1B visas. By and large, H-4 visa holders work for nonprofits or for the government or for community organizations. They can't qualify for an H-1B. Archna, though, who I profiled in my story, because she works in user design and that touches the tech space, she tried to apply for an H-1B, but she hasn't heard back yet. And it's sort of a signal to her that this country is not that friendly to foreign workers and immigrants like her. You know, it's making them reconsider why they're spending their lives working in a country that won't allow them to have the rights of other workers.
Reporter Sonia Paul in Oakland, California. Thanks, Sonia.
Thank you.
We leave you today with some thoughts that might apply to oh so many situations lately. They come in the form of song lyrics, and here's what they say. In everything we do daily, we should show respect to others. We can enjoy life in community without having to hurt, slander, or humiliate others. On the contrary, we should always show them respect and avoid hurting their feelings in any way. That's a translation. The song is sung in the Bambara language. It's called Bunya. The singer is from Mali. Her name is Fatoumata Jawara, and it's not just the lyrics that are inspirational. The music is too. Catchy, eh? You can watch Fatoumata Jawara's brand new video to Bunya at theworld.org/music. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. We'll be back tomorrow.
Public Radio International.